thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and my first guest today, Bassam Shakashiri, back with us. He's an emeritus professor of chemistry at UW-Madison, a national proponent for science and education, and we're talking with him about the importance of understanding science. We'll take a look as well as the upcoming elections and finding science in the arts as well. So are you curious about science? How do you learn more about science in everyday life? Bassam can answer the questions that may come to your mind. You can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Bassam Shakashiri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
I'm happy to be with you and with our listeners, Larry. But tell me, is it springtime in the upper Midwest? Maybe that's a topic you're going to take up with the weather guys.
We'll definitely be talking about that, Bassam, on the show. You know, you and I have done this show together for a long, long time, and it's rare that during one of those shows or any of those shows that you wouldn't mention science literacy in one way or another. So I know it's always been important to you. What is science literacy in your mind? What is science literacy for a science of Wisconsin or anywhere else for that matter?
Thank you, Larry, for giving me and all your guests the opportunities to visit with a fantastic set of listeners. Science literacy does not require detailed knowledge of any particular field of science. It's rather a broad appreciation and hopefully understanding of what science is capable of achieving, and equally important, you know, what science cannot accomplish. Science literacy is essential for the democratic process to work. You mentioned, you know, we're in an election year. We have elections all the time, but this year is very, very special. Science literacy refers to a broad appreciation and understanding of science and its practitioners and what science is capable of achieving and with what it cannot accomplish. I think it's very important for all of us to be literate in science, to develop a sense of appreciation, and for people who want to go deeper into it, an understanding of the intricacies of science, because science and technology are the engines that drive our economy. They affect our daily lives in so many different ways. The biggest difference between us and people 50, 100, 200 years ago is that we live in the most advanced society because of science and technology. And we need to understand and appreciate what science and technology are, how they differ from each other, and how they affect us personally and collectively.
Yeah. Well, when it comes to understanding science, how are we doing in this country?
Well, in colleges and universities and in schools, we're doing fairly well. We can always do better. With the public at large, there is a hunger, there's a thirst from the public to learn more about science and technology. There are some efforts, and I'm very pleased to be part of that, that attempt to reach everyone in society, but we're not doing a good enough job, Larry. It's because more scientists and more people in technology should exercise their rights as being residents, citizens of our society, responsible people of our society, and share their knowledge and their understanding and their appreciation of what science and technology are and how they can affect our society, mostly in good ways, but there are adverse ways. And Larry, I would be very much interested in having people in the listening audience today call in and tell us what they think about the importance of science and the importance of technology, and if they feel that there is a sufficiently good enough level of science literacy. I'm eager to hear from our listening audience.
Yeah, well, let me give the number. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Give us a call. What do you think about science and science education? Are we doing enough? What happens if we don't have a citizenry that is interested in understanding of science, at least in the general terms? What can happen, by the way, Bassam, if we don't have that?
Let me say one more time. Science literacy enlightens and enables people to make informed choices, to be skeptical, and to reject shams, quackeries, unproven conjecture, and to avoid being bamboozled into making foolish decisions where matters of science and technology, all matters in our society, are concerned. It's very important that we make good decisions, good judgments, based on sound information, being able to sort out reliable information from misinformation, from disinformation. That's something that has become very, very important now, especially as people use social media. And it's very important to be able to sort out what is reliable and what is not reliable so that we can make intelligent choices about matters that affect us, individually and collectively. It's very important to, as I keep saying, science literacy is for everyone. It is for scientists, it's for artists, it's for humanists, it's for the general public, it's for all professionals, it's for youth and adults alike. It's for everyone. Science literacy is an attitude. It's like personal hygiene, Larry. It should be something that we practice and learn from and make responsible decisions on the basis of what we know, and be able to sort out what is reliable information from what is not reliable.
Steve in Door County joins in. Let's hear from Steve. Thank you for calling, Steve.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me. I wanted to share an experience that I was able to take my wife and my two kids, 12 and 15, to the UW-Madison this weekend and experience the nuclear science merit badge, which they do through scouting. But they did a wonderful, wonderful job teaching the kids, showing them around. I wish I could remember the instructor's name, but she was very nice, very... Everyone there was just, and this was a great opportunity
to learn more
for myself.
Yeah,
to learn about, nuclear energy is all a bunch of questions and we're not really doing anything, but she was very helpful in explaining why things aren't happening and where we can go about making these changes to be more understanding of nuclear power and things like that.
Yeah. Well, Steve, thanks a lot for calling. Bassam, a comment.
Yes. Thank you, Steve, for this call. And I cannot overemphasize the importance of parental guidance in all kinds of activities that we should engage in. And Steve, thank you for calling attention to one event that happened. I think it's important that we think about the consequences of what we learn. It's not enough that we learn some things. It is more important that we decide how to act on what we learn. So nuclear power, for example, this is what you're talking about, Steve. I think we should learn more about that and its benefits, its potential hazards, how it can help us and how it can potentially be of harm to us. This is what we should do in every aspect of interacting with each other, not only on a weekend activity, which is great, but we should do it on a daily basis. Yeah. This is how we should live.
Steve, thank you again for calling, and we'll have some information coming up on another science expeditions are coming up April 5th through the 7th, and we'll talk about that in a bit, but thank you for calling. Tom and Nina will give you a chance. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Please have the speaker talk about when the science community makes a change with new information coming in, the old hypothesis or explanation is no longer valid, but we should still maintain confidence in the science as it explores and comes up with new explanations. Talk a little bit about how science works in that regard. Thank you, and I'll listen off the air.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Bissam?
Thank you, Tom. Very good question, Tom. Science is a dynamic process. There is no one set of answers that gets cast in stone, and that's it. We engage in explorations. We make corrections about findings that have been interpreted in one direction. Science is a way of looking at the world, and we improve the ways by which we look at the world. We improve our understanding of the beautiful, complex world that we live in. And scientists, picking up on what Tom is asking, Larry, scientists are very good talking with each other about their own discoveries. What we have to do is learn, we in science have to learn and have to become better at communicating with the general public to keep them interested in what we are doing, to keep them aware of the consequences of what we're doing, to share the joy of what we're doing. So science communication is critical. It is critical for a variety of reasons, but let me just mention one, and here I quote President Abraham Lincoln. He said, "Public sentiment is everything. With public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed." That's why we have to be literate in science so that we can affect public sentiment, so we can be part of people who are affecting public sentiment, all for the common good of society. All for the common good of society. To me, that's what science literacy is all about. It's not just to learn about the beauty and the complexity of what has been discovered. It's what to do about it. This is so critical in terms of the action that we as individuals and collectively do as a result of advances in science and in technology.
Bissam Shakashiri, our guest today. You can join in, too. The number 800-642-1234. You can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Trina LaSousa is our engineer today. Clara Neipert's our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Bissam Shakashiri, Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at UW-Madison, as we talk with Bissam about science and science literacy. We'll turn back to the phones and to Gary in the town of Ween. Gary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Larry, and thank you to your guests. I just enjoy your program all the time, and this is my favorite time, but I just have a comment. I have a new favorite t-shirt I wear, and it says science because figuring things out is better than making things up. And some people don't get it, but then they don't get a lot of things. So thank you again for the great show.
Well, Gary, you know, you're talking to our guest today is probably the T-shirt expert when it comes to promoting science. What do you think about that? Figuring things out instead of making things up. That's a good T-shirt, isn't it, Bissam?
It's excellent. Fantastic. Maybe I should put it on the back of the Science is Fun T-shirt that I wear all the time. We say science is fun. That's not just a logo. You know, that's a philosophy. That's a way of life. And when we talk about science being fun, we're not talking about cheap thrills. We're talking about being intellectually satisfied, emotionally being rewarded. We're talking about being engaged. We're talking about being figuring things out. And Larry, Gary makes a very good point. I hope, Gary, you wear that shirt all the time, and maybe get some more and give them as gifts to others to wear. I want to say one, go back to an earlier caller, Tom, who asked about, you know, when discoveries in science change and interpretation change and so on. It's very important that we learn about how to handle these changes, because what we're talking about is a process, a scientific process, through which we learn what the new discoveries tell us. And that means we have to be earning the trust and the confidence and the respect of the people that we talk with. So the element of trust and the element of respect and the element of confidence are crucial to every effective means of science communication.
Yeah.
We're all in this together. And this is why I repeatedly call for fuller participation, not only on the part of the scientists and people in technology in this process, but on the public, on the general public, to engage with us, just like we're doing on your show right now, Larry. This is so crucial for the effectiveness of the democratic process that we cherish and that we want to be protecting.
You know, Carl in Lone Rock has something that I think relates to kind of to what you're talking about. Let's go there. Carl, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I've been for some years kind of giving out a statement that that even if all the world's climate scientists who aren't in the pocket of the fossil fuel industry are wrong about us having an effect on the climate, maybe we should stop poisoning ourselves anyway. And I actually this morning was working with one of public radio sponsors, All Energy Solar, to put up a 100-panel display of solar electricity at my residence, which is actually a 8-unit apartment building. So, anyway.
Yeah, Carl, thanks a lot for calling. Bassam, comment.
Yes, Carl and everyone else, individual action is important. It's very important, and it has to be a responsible action. But we also should promote and help others, so we work collectively. One person, even 10 person, even 1,000 persons will not make the effect that is desirable. This is why, Larry, I want to bring this up now. This is why in this election year, we have to make sure that we elect people to represent us in terms of the laws and regulations that they're going to enact for the benefit of society, not for individual benefits, but for the common good. And it's crucial, really, that people like Carl say and do what they do, but tell others about it, so we can have collective action, and we can influence our elected officials, locally, at the state level, at the federal level, to do what is good to protect us and protect our planet.
Yeah, and this this whole business about he was getting at disbelief in climate scientists, and I know a jury recently ruled in favor of a scientist who's been working on climate change for a long time. I think it was over 25 years.
Yes.
You know that lawsuit, I assume.
Yes, Michael Mann. He's a climate scientist. He did a lot of studies that contributed to our understanding of the effect of greenhouse gases on climate. And he was personally and his family, they were attacked and subjected to unspeakable matters. And so he sued them back, and it took about 10, 12 years for the courts to act in his favor. and this has just happened. Michael Mann is an atmospheric scientist. He's at the University of Pennsylvania. He had done this work at Penn State before he moved to Pennsylvania a couple of years ago, to the University of Pennsylvania a couple of years ago. This is a telltale of how when people make statements about scientific findings, they are vulnerable. And Michael Mann and his family were vulnerable. This case is very well documented, and the action of the courts in the District of Columbia really that action is very important to make sure that when we engage in respectful conversations, if somebody says something about the climate and we don't understand it or we don't like it, we should engage in respectful conversations about the content of it and the meaning of the findings and the interpretation of the findings, rather than go into disinformation or misinformation and be attacking personally the scientist and his or her family.
Yeah. Do you think climate scientists are now receiving more respect for their research?
Well, I think climate scientists are viewed a little differently now than they were 10, 15, 25 years ago or so. But politically, it is still a hot issue because there are people who deny that global warming is real. In fact, Larry, you and I and everyone else listening have heard the expression that it's a hoax. It's not a hoax. It is based on sound scientific explorations. Conclusions are fairly well understood and agreed to. But in science, we always subject our findings to future research, to future explorations. So, but it's clear right now that global warming is undeniable. If some people want to engage discussing back and forth whether it's real and it's a hoax, okay, we can do that for maybe a minute or two, but we should not engage in prolonged conversations about the validity of it, because there is action that we can take and we must take to help mitigate global warming. We've had an example or two earlier in this show, Larry, but there's so much more that should be taken by our government locally, at the state level, at the federal level. We need to have elected representatives who truly understand the consequences of the research findings on climate change. And so we should listen to what climate scientists say. All of us should listen, but also engage them in meaningful back and forth conversations about the validity of what's being said, the interpretations that are being made, and what laws and regulations are to be put in place.
Let's go to Ron in La Crosse next, who has something relating to this, I believe. Ron, hello.
Yeah, I think the reason a lot of these people say that, you know, the consumption of fossil fuels is, they're thinking, well, how can all the BTUs and heat coming out of tailpipes and smokestacks warm the atmosphere, you know? And, of course, they don't understand it's nothing to do with the actual heat coming from the combustion of fossil fuels. It has to do with the carbon shroud. We're emitting more carbon into the atmosphere than settles to the earth. And, of course, the sun's infrared rays penetrate that carbon. And when they hit the earth, they convert to heat, and the carbon keeps the heat from escaping into space. And I think, you know, people were to – it's been explained often enough, but I think some people just – either that's the reason they misunderstand it, or they just don't want to believe it because it's bad news.
Yeah.
Well, you make a good point, Ron, and I'll just make a comment. As a classroom teacher, and I've taught for decades, I always said to myself, if someone does not understand what is being said, what's being taught, it's my responsibility to try differently. It's not that they don't want to understand. Some of them don't want to understand it. Yes, I personally respect that, and I choose the word respect deliberately here. But when it comes to matters that have an effect on all of us, and that's what global warming is, it's a matter that has an effect on all inhabitants of the planet, human and non-human. We have to devise different ways of communicating with each other with respect all the time. Respect the other person as a fellow human being. I'm not saying you respect what the other person says, but respect the other person as a fellow human being and engage in meaningful conversations about the consequences of what is happening. Otherwise, what good is it to learn something if we don't act on it?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, Chris in Rochester called, couldn't stay with us. He thinks what we do is amazing in terms of science education. Science is everything. He's a farmer, and it guides his life.
We do a good job, Larry and Chris and everyone else in the listening audience, but it's not good enough. We have to get better at it, and we get better at it by listening to what people say, people who are hungry, who are thirsty, to learn about discoveries, to learn about ways by which we can enjoy living in this beautiful, complex world that we are in. And so I think communication is always a two-way street. It isn't that one person is telling the other person what to do. It is a combined collaborative effort that has to be done with respect, with dignity, and with confidence.
Let's go to Vern in Eau Claire County next. Vern, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I'd just like to know if you guys ever heard of Leo Szilard, S-Z-I-L-A-R-D. He's the guy that came up with a nuclear vision, and along with Enrico Fermi. See, he wrote the letter to Roosevelt that Einstein signed to build the atom bomb. So did we advance by science? But this guy was a genius. And he's largely unknown. It wasn't Oppenheimer, it was Leo Szilard, a Hungarian Jew, that came to the United States around 1938, somewhere in there. You want to comment on him?
Yes, I have. Of course, I know who he was. I never met him personally, but science and scientific advancement happen because people devote their intellectual abilities to address problems that they may be curious about, but hopefully also that can address important societal issues. So, yes, nuclear research has a very rich history, both with European scientists, and many of them emigrated to the United States, and also with American scientists. And it's not any one person. It's the collective work, the collective contributions of people engaged in meaningful research inquiry and wanting to then share the results of what they do. And some of the discoveries that are made have good consequences. Some discoveries have not so good consequences. It's a matter of what judgment we individually and collectively exercise in learning first about these discoveries and then acting on what to do with them.
Bruce in Dover will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Bruce.
Bassam. This is just wonderful, like the universe, like infinity. My thoughts on the matter are, if we could just simply find the young people and explore the scientific method with them, it is so coherent with your statements and your philosophy. Find the young kids. Like you said, you've been in the classroom for decades. A child that isn't interested, okay, find a way. If they're not, respect them. And then we'll have public sentiment. And public sentiment is everything, because those young people are going to have to live in this warmed-up climate. Thank you, Larry. You're my favorite guy.
Bruce, thank you for calling. Comment, Bassam?
Thank you, Bruce. Yes, working with youth is always stimulating, challenging, and very rewarding. With actually working with kids of all ages. We're all kids, right, Larry? You're still a kid, right?
Yes, I am.
It's very important that we encourage our teachers, classroom teachers, let's all participate in PTA activities. Let's all participate in dealing with the advisors of our children who go to college. Let's all be involved in a number of meaningful interactions with each other so that we encourage people to engage in back and forth conversations like I'm advocating. So, well, you know, Bruce, the younger kids are the conduit to the adults. So it's the adults who bring the kids to a program, like we heard earlier in the show, right? And guess what? Not only did the kids learn, I hope they learned, but also the adults, the parents did. So I think it's meaningful for everyone to do things that are important to you. You decide what's important. But it's very important also to be sure that we're able to distinguish between misinformation, between disinformation, and reliable information. We should be able, let me put it bluntly, figure out when somebody's lying to us or somebody's not telling the truth from what the truth is, and we're able to act on it that way.
You know, earlier I mentioned in passing science expeditions coming up April 5th through the 7th. Let's talk about that a minute. And you've got you're going to be participating in that on Saturday, April 6th, I know.
Yes, science expeditions is a very important spring activity that happens at the campus of UW-Madison here. It is April 4, 5, and 6, invite everybody to visit the website. You have the website, Larry? But I am doing a program on April 6, which is a Saturday, at 12:30. The name of the program is The Joy of Science and the Arts, Celebrating 175 Years of UW-Madison. This is in connection with our series of celebrations of the birth of our university. And I am going to have not only science experiments, but be some art there too. There'll be musicians, not only doing science experiments, but they'll be playing some very interesting music. And so it's a Saturday, April 6th, at 12:30 at the Discovery Building at UW-Madison. You don't need tickets. It's a free event. It's open to the public, first come, first served. And I'll have more information about this event and other events on my website. Everybody knows my website. Larry, you know my website, right?
Yes.
www.scifun.org. And I invite everyone to come to the website, because browse around a little bit, you'll find experiments you can do at home. Download them and do them with family members. Tell teachers about them. We also have a YouTube channel. You can watch some fabulous recordings that have been made. And not only scientific explorations, but there are musical features on our YouTube channel. Just scifun.org, S-C-I-F-U-N.org. Everybody's invited. Everybody's welcome.
You know, you always have been interested in featuring many musicians and others in the arts and humanities along with science, and that seems to be very important to you.
It is important because I want to promote creativity in science, creativity in the arts, creativity in the humanities, and look at the intersections between science, the arts, and the humanities, and not only in the Christmas program that I've done for 5 decades, Once Upon a Christmas Cheery in the Lab of Shaka Cheery, where we featured musicians ranging from the Pro Arte Quartet to the UW Marching Band, to youngsters who are in high schools, to even younger people. Kids who are a part of the Madison Youth Choir. I think it's important to be part of a community that promotes avenues for creative expressions. And that's why I make the connections between science, the arts, and the humanities. And we'll be doing that, even though so briefly, but we'll be doing it on April 6th at the Discovery Building on campus.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. Bassam, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. I thought we had a good discussion today, got lots of good calls, and we'll look forward to another visit. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry, and thank you, everyone, for listening. But please take responsible action, especially in this all-important election year. Thank you.
Bassam Shaka Cheery is an emeritus professor of chemistry at UW-Madison. Again, he will be presenting The Joy of Science and the Arts on Saturday, April 6th from 12:30 to 1:15 on the UW-Madison campus. Free event. You can come. It's at the DeLuca Forum of the Discovery Building, which is a pretty cool building just in and of itself, and there'll be a whole lot more going on in that building and other buildings on the UW-Madison campus that weekend. So it's April 5th through the 7th is the what is called Science Expeditions, and Bassam is on Saturday, April 6th. Well, thinking about scientists, the weather guys are coming up next to talk about maybe the science of tornadoes, and what about popular folklore weather forecasts and rhymes? Well, they'll tell us about those as well. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You know, before this year, our state hadn't recorded a tornado during the month of February. Larry Mueller here. Today on the show, it's a weather update, and we'll start by talking about the tornadoes confirmed in southern Wisconsin with our half of the weather guys is here. The other half will be coming soon. Steve Ackerman with us, former Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John Martin will be with us. He's finishing up his class, so he'll be with us along about noon. He's Professor and former Chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be back here talking about weather.
Talking weather. And by the way, I didn't give the number, but if you have a question, maybe about tornadoes, maybe about something else relating to climate and weather, I hope you'll call in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. So earlier this month, there were tornadoes confirmed in Dane, Rock, and Greene counties. And this was a very unusual event.
It's definitely unusual in the sense that it was also a very proud fact to be able to memorize that we never had a tornado in February in Wisconsin. Of course, the other part of that is January has only had three. So it's unusual, but now, you know, we have a tornado in every single month of the year. And these were pretty devastating. There was an F2 tornado, which was on the ground for over half an hour, 30 miles long, 500 yards wide, Ooh. Which just astounds me. You know, that's five football fields. I just can't imagine a thing that big.
I wouldn't have wanted to been in front of it.
No, right. Yeah, yeah.
We had a lot of damage, but no deaths.
We had no deaths, right, that I'm aware of. Some houses were destroyed. Missing animals as well, so power lines down. I think I heard it was about $2.5 million worth of damages.
And, you know, the days leading up to the tornadoes, they were unseasonably warm. What were the specific conditions that led to it?
So typically when we have tornadoes like this, we have warm weather. I mean, that's why most of our tornadoes are in the season between May and August. And then when you have cold air come in over that, that makes the atmosphere really unstable. Because warm air is less dense than cold air. And so once you begin to lift that warm air near the ground, you can help generate these thunderstorms. And as long as you have upper level support, so the right divergence up above in the upper troposphere, then you can get really severe weather. Thunderstorms develop, which we have had in February, just not severe thunderstorms.
Yeah. Chuck in Vernon County emailed, he'll be canoeing the Green River south of Moab, Utah, in Canyonlands National Park in mid-May for about 10 days, and he won't have access to technology. So he's wondering, what are some signs that might indicate incoming weather, particularly wind and precipitation?
Wow, that's a really good question. What I would recommend is getting a weather radio so that if there is flooding going on, you know, heavy downpours in that river, you know, you could definitely get flooding in those rivers out in the west, particularly if there is canyons around. So I would get, emergency weather forecast, National Weather Service emergency weather radio, and that'll tell about severe.
You should be able to get that.
You should be able to get that, yeah.
And it would work.
It would work in those areas. It might, if you're in a canyon, then it might be harder to get the signals. But the emergency broadcast system works across the U.S. That's what I would listen for.
As you were talking, I was thinking about this last week when we interviewed the author of Gunflint Down, which was a derecho that hit July 4th of 1999 on 500,000 acres in the Gunflint. On July 4th, all these people out in the woods.
Yeah.
And he wrote the book about what happened. And in that case, weather forecasting, I think if that something like that were coming today,
we'd be much better than we were in the 1990s, late 1990s. That's what it was, 1999?
1999,
yeah. I mean, back then, derechos were really being studied to try and understand what they were caused. These are also called straight-line winds. They're just really strong winds, and there's a long line of them. And again, they often come out of thunderstorms as well.
Yeah, that one did. I think it took down 43 million trees.
43 million trees, Jay.
In the Gunflint there, in the park.
Right. Wow.
So it was.
Was he in the park as well?
No, but he's been there many a time before and since, and so he interviewed many people who had been there during it. So it was a really fascinating. All those people, there were people who were injured, but not a single death. And when you look at the damage of a storm like that, I can see where Chuck in Vernon County might be.
Oh, yeah. I know.
Maybe he heard the interview I did with the author of that book. Oh, my gosh. Rachel emailed, with an increase in tornado activity throughout the state, are there plans to expand and put in public tornado shelters? I have no idea about that.
I have no idea either. I mean, all the parks will have it. I'm sure there's a lot of, and we'll be seeing this as we approach more of our typical severe weather season, what to do when exposed or threatened by a severe weather. A lot of it is associated with, you know, go to your basement. Mm-hmm. Or if you don't have your basement, you know, go into a interior room like a bathroom. And if you really... looks bad, get in the bathtub, and that'll also help protect.
Yeah, I was actually, a news item came out today, how to protect your home. Things you can do to protect your home in case a tornado hits. Karen in Madison has a comment about a tornado warning. Karen, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I love your show, as you know. Maybe, but
thank you.
Back in 19, let's see, I think I was around 11 or 12, and that would be maybe 1965, 64, something like that. And it was January, and we were on our way to a gymnasium at a school function, and I heard tornado warning come over. You know, because I'm a disaster freak from birth. And so I said, I am not going anywhere, you know, and refused to go. And she refused. She was pulling me out the door. There aren't tornadoes in Wisconsin in January. And now they're.
Yeah.
Have a feeling that they're going to tell everyone in the country from now on, when there's severe weather, there's a chance an isolated tornado may come out.
Right.
Exactly. Well, January, and we've had three?
We've had three in January, so it is possible. And I think it was six in December as well. So, yeah, when those sirens go off, there's a good reason to seek shelter, because that means that severe weather is in your... If you can hear the siren, then you're threatened by the weather.
Overall, we've had a kind of a weird winter. I mean, the temperature... I mean, do you have any comparisons of this year's temperatures and the amount of precipitation to previous years?
Most of southern Wisconsin is like 10 degrees above normal in terms of temperature. Madison area is really below in terms of precipitation. I think we've had less than 3 inches in snowfall, and typically we have 13 inches in February. I think Milwaukee has about average in terms of snowfall, and there's probably some influence from Lake Michigan there. But yeah, it's been a really weird weather. High temperatures being broken in Madison this last week. Our minimum temperatures for the day were typically above the normal highs for the area. I mean, that's just
amazing.
Just an odd year.
And just to go along with that, another report I got this morning was from the DNR, and there's a very high increased risk of fires,
even
in the northern part of the state where there's just not snow cover.
Yeah, we've been really, really dry as a state as a whole. I think only the southern western part has had close to normal. But yeah, real big fire dangers, everything's dry, and we're going to have some wind move through the area on Tuesday and Wednesday. So if you burn your parts of your property in order to kind of support natural growth, be careful.
Yeah, don't do it.
Yeah, don't do it. It's a better advice.
Right now. And there's been wacky weather from other areas of the country.
Yeah, it's just been a really weird, weird year. And part of that is two things, I think. One is we still see, of course, the global warming trend that we've been experiencing now for decades. But also this is an El Nino year, and that usually means for the Wisconsin, upper Midwest, less snowfall and warmer type conditions. But It's been anomalous this year.
Well, we've got a number of emails rolling in, and I'm sure we'll be getting some questions as well. Steve Ackerman with us right now. I just looking through the glass, and I see John Martin has joined us and is waiting to come in as well. And he will be with us, too. And you can join in with your weather question or comment, or if you got an experience to share, we always love to hear those as well. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. We're going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with Steve Ackerman and joined by John Martin. I'm Larry Mehler for the Ideas Network. Getting a weather and climate update today on the show. Larry Mehler here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Steve Ackerman with us, one of our guests for the rest of the show. He's the former Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and welcoming John Martin with us. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. Nice to be here.
John's a professor and former Chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. So, weather and climate questions, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Dean, who's out west of Denver, Colorado, has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dean.
Hey, guys. Thanks for being out there. We enjoy listening to your show every month. Unfortunately, it's every month. Why isn't it twice a month, Larry?
You'll have to ask my executive producer, Jill Nadeau, about that. Oh, gosh.
Well, you know, and I have to keep notes in my mind for a whole month, one of which was a follow-up from Steve's comments last month about anemometers. And I was working with a research-grade sonic anemometer, uses 3 kilohertz sound waves to measure wind speed, and quite a remarkable invention, if you will. It has a resolution on the order of a millimeter per second.
Wow!
For wind speed.
That's unbelievable.
which translates to for those of non-metric folks to about 10 feet an hour.
Jeez, unbelievable.
So,
that's amazing. Yeah. And that you use that for anyway, research, or just you have that as your...
I was working on surface layer meteorology. That's down near the Earth's surface. We're measuring carbon exchange using a technique called eddy covariance. We there are a few firms out there making those, chief of which was in the U.S. Outfit in Utah. But anyway, we used them quite, that was part of the regimen of measuring that exchange of carbon dioxide, for instance, between the Earth's surface and the atmosphere. Anyway, last week, I think it was a sort of groundbreaking research that came out. I shouldn't say that, but anyway, it was more eye-opening, let's say that, on the shutdown of the Gulf Stream with the reduction of circulation and the overturning circulation in the Atlantic, which I guess is somewhat due to the meltwater coming off of Greenland. I was wondering if maybe you guys would fill in a little more of the details on what you think is the uncertainty of that prediction.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dean, thanks for calling. John, go ahead.
Yeah, that is a troublesome prediction, Dean. I agree with you. My dad and I were talking about it the other day. In fact, he's concerned about it. There's a couple of high-profile factors that keep the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation going, and the Gulf Stream's part of that at the surface. And that is evaporation in the storm track in the northeast Atlantic, northwest Atlantic, south of the Labrador Sea in Greenland, and then cold air that physically cools the water. And both of those make it heavier, and it sinks at that location. And that sinking drives the whole circulation. So one of the, as you pointed out, one of the things that's of concern is that if you start to flood the North Atlantic, the Northwest Atlantic, mouth of the Labrador Sea, with fresh meltwater, it changes the whole stability structure of the water column and prohibits the same intensity of subsidence of the sinking of the water. And that could be a big factor in shutting down the circulation. So to shade the discussion, I have a feeling that what's happened with these simulations is that the rapid cessation of that circulation is now one of the plausible solutions in these models. I wouldn't say that it's the most probable solution. And I think that that's probably where it lies, that it's not, you know, if it happened tomorrow or next week or next year, a number of us would be surprised. Not everyone would be surprised, but it's I would say it's probably in the 5 to 10% probability event instead of, you know, right in the heart of the most likely outcome for the next 10 or 15 years. That's my sense of it from a distance.
So what happens if, you know, what's the worst case scenario on that?
Does this pick the Northern Europe? Is that where it really
yeah,
is?
Yeah, I mean, it's a suddenly, even Northern United States, Northeast United States are suddenly thrust into a realm, a climate realm that's a lot colder than the one we have now. Because the Gulf Stream is pumping tropically warmed surface water and through a depth well poleward. And that water is an insurance policy against being at high latitude and being starved of photons and warming up in the winter. So we were just talking about it in class. People have palm trees on their little patios in front of houses in London. Now, there's no reason why that should be true latitude-wise, but it's because they're at the end of the Gulf Stream. And Northwest Europe has benefited from that for a long, long time, of course. If it suddenly shut down, things would be vastly different in a lot of heavily populated areas.
A lot colder.
A lot colder.
A lot longer.
A lot colder for a lot longer. So it's one of the wheels in the climate machine that is susceptible to change and maybe sudden change.
And would that then feed back in terms of sea ice conditions?
You'd think, yeah.
Colder, so
yeah, you'd think it would.
Pretty quick.
Yeah, and then you put a little more ice at the mouth of the Labrador Sea. You can't have the evaporation. All sorts of things get out of whack. Yep.
Yeah. Interesting.
Well, on that happy note, Dean, thank you for calling.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, man. Jimmy in Valley Junction, we'll go to you next. Jimmy, hi. Thanks for calling.
Afternoon, gentlemen. I just had a question. It's supposed to be really warm for a few days and then drop like 35, 40 degrees to 25. I can't remember if it was Wednesday or Thursday.
Wednesday.
Normally, when you have such a temperature change, there's severe weather, and it doesn't appear that's the case this time. Do you know why it's not setting up for severe weather?
It's a good question, Jimmy. Part of the severe weather threat comes a little more in the warmer season, where you can still get a pretty decent, early in the warm season, you can get a pretty good drop in temperature, and you have to worry a little bit more about thunderstorms then. This air that's over us now is quite warm, but part of the reason it's warm is because it's been forced to subside in the lee of the Rocky Mountains, so it's moisture starved. We don't really have a lot of water vapor in this air that's going to warm us up today and tomorrow. And so the consequence is when the cold front that's going to be fairly intense, the passage Tuesday night into Wednesday morning is going to be really intense. There will be a 30-degree temperature drop in the high temperature from Tuesday to Wednesday, but it's not going to meet air that's got sufficient humidity to really play any nasty games with us, it doesn't look like. So that's part of it. And that's a function of being at the end of the winter as opposed to the middle of the spring, I think.
And then it warms up again.
And then it warms up. This is a very temporary cool down. Wednesday will be cold, and you'll be, you know, shedding your jacket Thursday afternoon because it'll be in the mid-40s and then 50 and 60 on Friday and Saturday. So,
yeah.
Amazing. Roller coaster.
Jimmy, thank you for calling. Let's go to Carolyn in La Crosse next. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. I was just wondering what happened to those Canadian wildfires? How did they resolve any of that?
Yeah.
Never heard.
That's a really good question. From last year, there was a lot of burning in the northwest and in the northwest and in the east.
In the east, too. Yeah. Ontario.
Yeah, all that smoke was coming over us.
I can tell you that this second winter in a row, the northeastern part of North America has been snow-starved. There has not been a lot of snow. And that was one of the factors that maybe led to the fires in Ontario. And I'd heard, and this is anecdotal only, so I can't tell you anything more than, and I don't even remember where I heard it, but a lot of this subterranean burning still at the root balls of trees. So some of those fires are not technically out yet. And so I don't know what that means for the coming fire season. I that might be spectral evidence. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I've heard that. So,
but it is dry again.
Yeah, it's dry again. So. No snow. A lot less snow than normal up there. Yep.
And even here, because as Steve and I were talking earlier, the DNR just issued another fire warning.
Is that right?
For the state, the whole state. So, there's that problem. Carolyn, thank you. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Ray in West Bend wonders, are there any insights on the clockwise spinning West Bend tornado of, he thinks, around 1980? Clockwise.
There's no preference, as it turns out, for clockwise or counterclockwise rotation of tornadoes. It really depends on the storm from which they're spawned. And so I shouldn't say there's no preference. Statistically, there is. Statistically, there is. But there's no dynamics that mandates that. I should have said it that way.
So we do have
both
directions, counterclockwise and clockwise.
It's interesting. I wish I knew more details about the storm. But I think one thing that you can imagine is that the vorticity, the spin that comes from that manifests itself in tornadoes, starts out as being oriented horizontally, not vertically. And so if there's a big updraft, you can split that horizontal vortex into two vertical vortices with opposite rotation. It's usually true that the one on the right, I think, which is going to turn counterclockwise, survives longer. But there must have been some circumstances that allowed the left one to survive in that case. And it may have left and right wrong.
Yeah.
Gene from La Crescent, Minnesota, had wondered about, this dry business, the large deficit of precipitation. Wondering what are the chances of overcoming that large deficit this spring and summer, and what is causing this drought?
Go ahead.
Two things came to my mind is, Jerry, we're in an El Nino year, and this usually means it's going to be drier in the upper Midwest. I think if you wanted to make it up, you don't want to make it up all at once.
That's right.
You would want to have just steady, gentle rain for multiple days to try and overcome the drought that we're in.
Anytime you're in the deficit, I couldn't agree more. It's the now the distribution that matters almost more than the amount.
Yeah,
if it's distributed incorrectly, it's worse
than
prolonging the drought almost. It's a very good question. I think that lack of snow on the ground is going to make it even worse. Right. Because the ground will be dry. Now, on the other hand, maybe there's a benefit to that, that if you get a few exceptional rain events, the ground can absorb it better than it might otherwise, not having, lost water in over the wintertime. And so, it's so many different factors that go into what the right answer is. But one of the right answers is it's got to start to precipitate, and it hasn't done that much in the last 8 or 9 months yet, that's for sure.
Back to the Canadian wildfires. Neil in Madison has some info on that. Let's go there. Neil, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call, folks. My name's Neil. I live in Madison, and I have relatives in Canada. And actually, the information I got on the subterranean continuation of the wildfires came from the As It Happens radio show that I heard last Thursday on your radio station. Uh-huh. And what they were saying is of the many hundreds of, actually many thousands of wildfires that happened last summer, some dozen of them are continuing underground because they're burning in an area that has fairly rich subterranean fire fuel. Mm. The other thing that they has come out is they've found that some notable fraction of these fires were deliberately set. They've charged the Mounties have charged four people with arson in starting backcountry fires, and they suspect there's more of that going on. So anyway, just thought I'd feed that into the fire.
Yeah. Thanks, Neil. Appreciate
creating that fuel.
Scott in Garden, Michigan, we'll go to you. Scott, hi.
Hi. Can you tell me the percent of El Nino years compared to the years with El Nino mm-hmm. in the past?
Yeah, is there...
Oh. Yeah, the ENSO oscillation is like, what is it, 2 to 7 years or something like that?
Right,
so
yeah.
I guess probably 30% of years are El Nino years historically, something on that order, yeah. but I don't really know. That's a good question.
Yeah.
But it's easy to look it up. The National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration has a page dedicated entirely to the El Nino Southern Oscillation, so you can find that information probably relatively easily. Although I bet you'd have to construct that particular piece of it.
I bet you would.
Just looking at the number of years and dividing by the total number of them, yeah. But I bet it's around 30-ish percent,
yeah.
my guess.
There you go, Scott. Thank you. Jolie in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Jolie.
Hello. The question I want to ask is with the lack of snow that Wisconsin is having, and how is that going to affect the lakes in northern Wisconsin and the Mississippi River?
Mm. That's a really good question. Mm-hmm. I was actually looking at that, although I didn't look at the level of the Mississippi River. The Madison area lakes are all at their current wintertime minimum, and I think they're trying to maintain that. Michigan, to my surprise, is just about its normal level, Lake Michigan.
Oh, yeah,
I thought that,
that
would be below.
Yeah.
And I didn't find the data on what the status was for Lake Superior.
Yeah.
But I would have thought that both of those, due to the lack of winter ice coverage,
right.
would have evaporated and been lower than normal.
So maybe the extra ingredient is there has to be a parade of storms that bring the winds up over the lakes. And we haven't really
had that.
You know, so there's less
evaporation
then. But I didn't know it was so sensitive to the wind speed over the integration of 90 days in the winter. Maybe it is.
Yeah.
Wow.
It would have an effect on the amount of lake weeds and algae. If you've got snow cover, if you don't have snow cover, there's sunlight getting through the ice and keeping those plants alive.
Hey, yikes. That makes it worse then.
Yeah, that will, that'll actually make it worse.
I was just thinking of the Madison Lakes now.
No kidding. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
We had a listener call us, couldn't stay with us. There's a movie called Kiss the Ground. It's about how we do agriculture and how it dries the soil. We don't use cover crops a lot. There was an image from a NASA satellite about the hot air circulating the globe. They called it a red zone, and hot air that rises into the atmosphere while farmers are harvesting. She wondered if that was accurate, and I don't know that we have that information offhand, but Steve?
Yeah, I'd want to see what the map looks like to get it, but yeah, if we generally have dry conditions and no clouds, then the NASA satellites are going to be able to see down to the ground and do accurate measurements of the surface temperature, and that might lead to low-level temperatures above normal in the atmosphere because the ground is so warm. I mean, once the ground gets wetter, you have snow cover on there, that solar energy isn't going to heat the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at harvest time, once you take the, you know, the stalks down of cornfields, for instance, it is going to be, if the next day is sunny, it's going to be warmer over your field because you got brown dirt exposed that you didn't have exposed for months.
Yeah.
So I think the choice of quote, hot air is intentionally provocative, however. I think it might mean elevated temperatures on the next day or something, but, you know, the atmosphere can absorb that. That happens quite naturally.
That's true. That red area is probably departure from normal.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah,
yeah that's exactly right.
Denise in Blanchardville, your turn. Hi, Denise.
It's Dennis.
Oh, Dennis.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question. I guess, can you... be, I guess, completely honest in saying that the jets in the jet stream, the sheer quantity of them, is not affecting our weather, especially our distribution of rainfall? I mean, because after all, those jets moving through the jet stream are molecularly changing, you know, that pattern up there. So, I mean, can you honestly say that the jets... And they project that there's anywhere from 60 to 65,000 jets on a daily basis flying in the jet stream. I don't know if that's accurate, but I mean, I don't see how that cannot be influencing our weather, especially our distribution
of because I've been an amateur astronomer for 67 years, and what I notice, and that is I can tell the corridor between Minneapolis and Chicago, that corridor, the sky, as I look through it with pretty large telescopes, I can actually tell the difference in that in the early part of the evening and actually throughout the night, as opposed to areas that's not where that corridor is constantly being bombarded with jets going through. And that's the reason why I say that. To me, it just seems like a no-brainer that that's having a
is working. Yeah, yeah, okay. Well,
I mean, one of the things, particularly for astronomers, with the when the jets are up there, if the conditions are right in terms of the vapor structure in the atmosphere, they can generate contrails, and they can spread out and get a thin cirrus all across a region. But it's not, they're not going to be, I can confidently say they're not going to change the jet stream.
Yeah.
It's just too much mass.
Yeah, it's a problem of proportion, as Steve's pointing out. It's definitely true. There's no doubt that locally at a moment there's some impact, but systematically there's no impact because the mass of the atmosphere and the way it's distributed by solar radiation and everything overwhelms these perturbations, which doesn't argue for making more of them, certainly, but it does not have any systematic impact.
Yeah, it's like having a football team out on a team. You know, you can have a lot of them running really, really fast, but if the day is windy, they're not going to influence.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They won't change the wind structure in the stadium. Yeah, that's right.
So it's good, the proportion.
That's an excellent description.
Dennis, thanks for calling. John in Onalaska, have you got a quick question?
Yeah, I've been worrying about the India. You know, India has a period where it gets very, very hot. And then, of course, the rains come and cool things off. But those rains are very important for all of Southeast Asia. And I've heard that that might change. What do you know about that?
I don't know about forecasts for the global monsoon to be substantially impacted or in what way. I wouldn't say that I would never say that no one's made those predictions and followed the reasoning all the way to the end. I just am not aware of it. I know there are stops and starts to the Indian monsoon. Some years it's very beneficial. Some years it's not. It doesn't come on till late, and it doesn't really deliver the rain that the country and the region expects. But that's been true for hundreds of years. I don't know if it's become exacerbated in the modern era. I don't know that.
Matt in Appleton wonders, will 2024 be seen as the beginning of the end of winter in Wisconsin?
No.
I don't know.
We speak, at least I speak hopefully.
Yeah, me too. Mine's entirely ambition. I don't want this to be a winterless place. On the other hand, property values will go up. I mean, really, this might be a climate oasis the way things seem to be going. You know.
On that happy note, we will conclude today. Thank you so much, John and Steve, for being with us. Always a pleasure. And we'll see you the last Monday of the coming month. Steve Ackerman is one of our guests today, emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John Martin, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, our guests. Tomorrow it's a pet care day, so we'll look at puppies and getting a puppy and covering everything connected with it. That's tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.